welcome to this special sitting of the Court of Appeals. We only have one case on the docket. Counsel are set up. Have both of you had a chance to look at our written procedures?
Yes.
Does either of you have any questions? In that case, we're ready for argument. It's 15 minutes aside.
Your Honors, please the court, counsel. What we're here for today is the people's appeal of a district court affirmation or granting of a defendant's 35C motion. Specifically, what we have is a circumstance where Alan Suddeth pled guilty to second-degree murder and aggravated robbery in 1995. He was sentenced January 17th of 1996. He was a juvenile at the time, but he was direct filed because of the aggravated nature of his offense. What occurred over time was that Mr. Suddeth sent letters, things he proposed were motions to the court, and those were denied by the court. Specifically, a letter in April was sent, April of 96 was sent. And that letter was an informal letter asking the court to consider granting him counsel for the purposes of attacking his conviction, his plea, because he just found out that there was a $20 bill recovered from the victim. The court denied that, or treated that as a 35C motion, and denied that motion on July 10th, 1996.
Now, defendant never got that order. Is that agreed upon?
It is not agreed upon. There is no evidence to that effect. It's been asserted by defense counsel in briefs, but I see no factual basis within the record for that assertion. It's contained in the record. The denial is stamped. There's no indication that it was not sent to the defendant that I'm aware of.
Didn't the district court so find in its January 2010 order?
There was no factual basis for that finding. So I can see nothing in the record that supports that finding.
So you have to show it's clear error then on that ground.
Well, the court, in the situation of the findings of fact, this court must consider or give deference to that court's finding of fact, unless there is not factual basis within the record to support it. Here I'm asserting there's no factual basis to support that. Additionally, this court must consider not just those findings of fact, but the uncontested facts that exist within the record as well. So a court is not allowed to make findings of fact and ignore those uncontested factual things within the record.
Don't you have arguments as a matter of law that you'd rather focus on than factual arguments?
I certainly can.
Okay.
Let's focus in on that issue of the time bar. In the court's finding regarding the time bar, it made no effort to comply with the dictates of People versus Wiedemann. That is not, the dictates describe or indicate factors the court must consider in determining whether or not there was justifiable excuse and excusable neglect. It's a seven-prong factor analysis, and it's not exhaustive. But the court in Wiedemann indicated that these factors must be considered. It is not a discretionary thing. This is not given to the court for guidance. This is a dictate handed down by case law in evaluating justifiable excuse and excusable neglect. And the district court here made absolutely no effort to comply with that dictate by applying these factors under Wiedemann. That, as a matter of law, is error. And the court's findings in this regard must be reversed because it failed to do so. At a minimum, return back to the district court for findings applying the Wiedemann standard. That's the legal argument as it pertains to the time bar.
16.5.402, sub 1, addresses this issue specifically. It does not provide tolling for the situation that faced Mr. Sutton. And it, while it does provide an exception for justifiable excuse and excusable neglect, this court erred by not applying the appropriate legal standard in making that determination in favor of the defendant. Assuming for the purpose of argument, however, that there was justifiable excusable neglect, I'm going to address the three other issues that the prosecution raises. First, the issue of whether or not there was deficient performance by counsel and whether or not the defendant was prejudiced by that performance under Strickland versus Washington. The suggestion being that his attorneys provided ineffective assistance of counsel. In order to prove deficient performance, the defendant must show that counsel made errors so egregious that counsel was no longer functioning as the, quote, counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Here, while there is a blanket statement that there was a failure to investigate the facts, a failure to investigate the weaknesses of the prosecution's case, and a failure to investigate defenses, what the facts really boil down to that support this claim is that his attorneys, Mr. Sutton's attorneys, did not hire an expert to assess the trajectory of the bullet that killed the victim in this case, Mr. Myers. That's the sole issue that supports that argument, and that was proffered by defense counsel to support that argument. That by itself, when reviewed de novo, is insufficient to show there was deficient performance. What we have in the circumstances presented to these attorneys, and that is the circumstance that must be analyzed, is what were these attorneys faced with when they were determining whether or not to advise the defendant to take the plea or not take the plea, and what his options were. What they had was a difficult client who was not communicative. The best they could get from their client was that, yes, he was the person with the gun, and yes, his actions ultimately resulted in Mr. Myers being shot. He claimed at one point that he dropped the gun, and that's what killed Mr. Myers. But what we know and what the attorneys faced is that he put the gun in his own hands, and it was his actions that killed Mr. Myers. The idea that a trajectory analysis, or a failure to get an expert on trajectory analysis, by itself constituted robbing the defendant of counsel as described by the Sixth Amendment simply is not supported by the standard articulated by Strickland. In Strickland, they specifically said that the reasonableness of counsel's actions may be determined by the defendant's own statements or actions. Counsel's actions are usually based, quite properly, on informed strategy choices made by the defendant and on information supplied by the defendant. The suggestion that they failed to do their job to such a degree that it violated the defendant's constitutional rights in light of the defendant's own statements is plain error. Additionally, the defendant must have shown that there was prejudice, that there was a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result would have been different, or in the context of a plea, that he would not have accepted the plea. The facts that were presented here indicate that the defendant knew that Mr. Reed was claiming responsibility and that there was no objective evidence presented except for the defendant's own self-serving statement that he was prejudiced and he would have not entered that plea to support the prejudicial, the claim of prejudice. What we know is that there is an objective evidence standard in the state of Colorado dealing with prejudice. And the record, the only record of prejudice in this case that is objective, does not support the belief that, or that does not support the assertion that there was in fact prejudice such that the defendant would have withdrawn his plea or not entered into that plea. What we do have is what the record does show is that the evidence, the defendant still would have entered into this plea. We know that he was claiming that he had the gun, that he dropped it and it killed Mr. Meyer, that he was taking responsibility for the shooting itself, at least to his attorneys. And that's really the question we have to answer is, did his attorneys have this information? And they in fact did. We know that the prosecutor at the day of the plea indicated that the co-defendant was taking responsibility and that the $20 bill was located. That didn't influence or change the defendant's view that this was inappropriate or it didn't dissuade him from his course of action. Under the circumstances, under the totality of the circumstances, neither deficient performance nor prejudice have been established by the defense. And the court's findings to the contrary were made in error. Which brings me to my third point. Defense raised an issue of the discovery of new evidence. Their claim is based on them subpoenaing Nick Reed to the 35C hearing and having him testify that he was the shooter. He was responsible for this killing. Their claim is that that constitutes new evidence and that thus he should be allowed to withdraw his plea or the plea should be vacated. People versus Schneider is the case that gives us the standard on which the court must assess these circumstances when it pertains to a plea bargain. And the court, the Supreme Court in that case, recognized that when there's a plea, there is an admission by the defendant. And thus it must be viewed or treated in a manner that is different from Garcia, which dealt with when the defendant went to trial and new evidence is discovered. Specifically, they articulate three different things the court must find were shown by the defendant. That the evidence was discovered after the plea and could not have been discovered earlier with the exercise of diligence, that the charges themselves were actually false, and that the new evidence would probably bring about an acquittal. The evidence provided here, the content of the evidence provided here, is that Nick Reed was taking responsibility for the shooting and thus was the primary or principal member who committed the murder. The defendant had this information prior to the plea. There was evidence that would have supported that. Does not constitute new evidence. Nick Thomas.
Well, maybe it may be newly available. It's not newly discovered. Is that your
correct?
It's new evidence. It's newly available.
It is new evidence, but it's the material or the nature of that evidence is the same. In other words, the content of the evidence is still the same. The jury would have heard that same information simply through other witnesses. Specifically, Nick Thomas, and I'm drawing a blank on the girl's name who overheard the conversation. And
the jury would have heard it. Why? Is it declaration against interest?
That's correct.
Don't you have to make a finding of reliability under that exception?
Well, we can't go down that road and second guess, but the bottom line is that there is an exception that could have been asserted and that would have allowed, or at least arguably would have allowed the jury to hear the evidence.
You stipulated that was a reliable, would the prosecution stipulate that that was a reliable claim of responsibility? That was contrary to your theory of the case?
I make no assertions regarding its reliability or even whether or not that reliability determination is necessary. I simply am indicating that there is a hearsay exception that is within the code of the rules of evidence that would have allowed
the admission of that evidence.
For libel, by its own terms. Isn't that, I mean, that's in the rule. I'm not making that up, am I?
That may be. I'm not going to make assertions in that regard. I'm simply noting that there are exceptions within the rule. But that addresses the first point. The second point is whether the charges were actually false. And the vast bulk of evidence that was provided to the court under this 35C analysis was that he was in fact guilty. At least it was sufficient to disprove that the charges were actually false in the consent of the defendant must show. The defendant provided evidence at the 35C hearing in the form of police reports. Those police reports are uncontroverted. In other words, all of that evidence is considered by this court as something it must consider under the totality of the circumstances. And when viewing all of that evidence, there is no way legally that the defendant has established, proved, that the charges were actually false. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, ADC counsel for the appellee, and I was the last of the string of post-conviction counsel below as well. Briefly, I'd like to address that last point first, the DA's assertion that the police reports are uncontroverted, that the charges against Alan Suttis were false. The opposite is true. Over and over and over again in those police reports, we have Nicholas Reed saying, "I am the shooter." In fact, when he was arrested, he spontaneously burst out to the police officer who was arresting him, "Hey, did you hear about that cab driver I shot the other night?" So no, it's not uncontroverted that the police reports clearly established that Alan Suttis was the shooter.
Ms. Ruttenberg, I mean, doesn't that undercut your case? I mean, you're saying that 12 years before he came forward again and said he was the shooter, he had said over and over before that he was the shooter.
What's new is now that those statements are reliable in light of his sworn testimony that he was the shooter, and in particular that he lied about not being the shooter in order to get his plea bargain. Therefore, if the trial will be held now, the defense would call Nicholas Reed to the stand to confess. The prosecution would try to impeach him with his prior inconsistent statements at his disposition hearing. And then we have the classic rehabilitation with the prior consistent statements he made to Officer Ortiz and Amy Thomas and all the other members. And so we do have the case of newly discovered reliable evidence because it was sworn testimony under oath, and he is explaining that he lied and why he lied in order to get his plea agreement.
I'm following up on that. Where would that get you? I mean, the evidence, it seems to me, that he was your client was at least a complicitor and therefore equally guilty of the offenses seems overwhelming. So even if his co-passenger in the car had fired the gun, he'd be just as guilty. So where does it get you?
No, I completely disagree. Just because somebody is there when somebody else commits a murder does not make him a complicit, or even if he handled the weapon prior to the murder. There is zero evidence that they had an agreement they were going to murder the cab driver. The only agreement they had prior to this offense was that they were going to engage in a jack move. That's not a carjacking. There's a little bit of confusion among some of the adults here, but it's clear in the police reports. So what the kids meant by a jack move was that they were going to run away from the cab driver without paying. That was the crime these kids conspired to commit, not murder, not robbery, not aggravated robbery, not carjacking.
But we have to look at this in light of what counsel knew at the time. And what counsel knew at the time was that their own client was telling them that he was the shooter.
The district court in this 35C hearing did not make that finding a fact. The district court heard contradictory evidence from Alan Suttis that no, he did not say that, and then he heard it from trial counsel that maybe he did say it. She wasn't very clear. And he assessed the relative credibility of those two witnesses based on their demeanor and their body language and the totality of their testimony. And he refused to find, in accordance with the DA's proposed findings of fact, that Alan Sutter did in fact confess to his counsel.
Did he make a finding that he didn't?
No.
Okay.
There is no finding of fact that Alan Sutter, at the 35C hearing, upon which all these rulings are based, that Alan Sutter ever confessed to shooting the cab driver. And the findings of fact that the district court did make are consistent with Nicholas Reed shooting the cab driver and there being no complicitor liability because there was no prior agreement to engage in an aggravated robbery or a homicide. And it just simply isn't true that the entire basis of the findings of ineffective assistance of counsel only turn on the fact that defense counsel didn't hire an expert to analyze the bullet trajectories. That's just one of many failings of defense counsel.
Before we get there, can I bring back to the time, the alleged time bar? Under your theory, the claim, the 35C claim, would accrue in July of 96, and I think that the people may dispute that, say it should be January, but is that right? Your theory is he reaches the age majority in July of 96, that's when the three-year clock runs, begins running.
Three-year clock began.
Begins, all right, so it would expire then in July 99,
if not told.
Right. And the claims upon which I think relief were granted, putting aside this alleged newly discovered evidence, is ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to investigate. When is the first time a claim based on failure to investigate was actually filed or raised by the defendant? Wasn't it sometime in around 03?
Well, Mr. Sutter first tried to raise that in his 1996 letter.
The April 96, I thought that was limited to the $20 was found on the cab driver, and therefore let me withdraw
right. The
robbery plea only was his
word. You can't withdraw a plea piecemeal. It's a global disposition, so it either gets withdrawn or it stays. Now, my argument specifically is, even if the DA is correct that the time bar began in January of 96 and it ended in January of 99 and it was never told sooner, that the neglect of Sharon Lyko when she was appointed in September of 1998 provides justifiable excuse and excusable neglect, because if she had read the transcripts, if she had looked at the district court record, and she admits that she didn't think it was her job to even look at the district court record to be sure that all issues had been appealed, then she would have realized that there was a lot of red flags waving. And Tom Carberry, the expert witness.
Excuse me. Are you saying that her appellate advocacy was ineffective, or are you saying that she had responsibilities to the defendant that went beyond her appointment as his appellate counsel to litigate the appeal effectively? Or I suppose both.
Both. Our expert witness testified, and he was uncontradicted, that when appellate counsel is appointed in this type of situation with an indigent, uneducated juvenile, that you've got to at least look at the district court record and be sure that his attempts to perfect his pro se notice of appeal were valid. He didn't even get all the issues in there. He didn't realize that prior attempt to withdraw his plea had even been addressed by the court. She should have, as a very minimum, advised him what he needed to do to perfect all of his issues before the time bar ran. There's also
counsel, how did she know what his issues were? The only thing in the record at that point in time when she was appointed was the April 96 letter, which all it mentioned was the $20 bill and all it mentioned was the robbery plea. That was it.
Well,
that was the only thing in the record. So if you're saying she had to go back and look at the record, that's all she's going to see. She's not going to see any Rule 35C motions that hadn't been appealed. Those hadn't been done yet.
The letter was considered by the district court to be a Rule 35C motion. I think that part is not contradicted by anybody. What the only disputed issue is whether the defendant received a copy of that.
wasn't a testimony, apart from that letter, the testimony was that he's asking her to research investigation.
And she's saying, it's not my job.
Well, let's follow up if it is her job. Notwithstanding the expert testimony, she was appointed to effectuate a limited statutory right, not a constitutional right to post-conviction count, a limited statutory right triggered when a court, in this case it would be our court in 98, right, finds arguable merit to a claim. And so this court, implicitly in 98, would have found arguable merit to his claim that he was denied an evidentiary hearing on advice or allegedly mistaken advice about the consecutive versus concurrent, right? That was the ground upon which she was appointed. And that's the only right that he had to counsel, was if a court found arguable merit in a claim that had been raised already.
Well, wait a minute. I don't want to confuse the Strickland test with the neglect of counsel test in Valdez, because I don't think we have to show that she was ineffective pursuant to a Silva standard in order to get justifiable excuse and excusable neglect under Valdez. If she had done what ADC counsel is expected to do in these types of situations, when we get these uneducated, indigent defendants, and sometimes we're the last, you know, we're the last port of call, is to just take a few minutes to look through the record and say, look, you didn't properly brief that. You need to either supplement your motion, or we need to get a limited remand and ask for counsel to be appointed so that findings of fact and conclusions of law can be made on the original issue of withdrawing your plea. She did none of that. And that type of neglect, which Tom Carberry testified she had a duty to do, and it wasn't a constitutional duty, but that type of neglect is what supplies the justifiable excuse, excusable neglect, because he kept on trying to raise these issues in various forms as he got older and better educated and more cynical.
Help me understand this. So you're saying that even if his appellate counsel's shortcomings did not rise to a constitutional level, those shortcomings are still sufficient to toll under Wiedmaier?
To toll under close pursuant to Valdez.
Okay, is there any Colorado case that draws that distinction?
Not yet. The problem with this case is there are a lot of facts here showing neglect by the district court, the clerks, various levels of post-conviction counsel, beginning with Sharon Lyko and beginning with whether Mr. Suddeth even received that order in the first place. And we don't have a lot of case law yet in Colorado construing what constitutes justifiable excuse and excusable neglect. So, you know, my position is that since Valdez just talks in terms of neglect of counsel, it doesn't talk in terms of ineffective assistance of counsel, that is a lesser standard, and that we have shown neglect of counsel due to her failure to, even when he requested her to do it, but she should have done it sooner and realized that there were portions of the record missing, and she had, as a very minimum, should have asked for a limited remand back to the district court so that the record could have been completed, or a limited remand so the district court could have entered findings of facts and conclusions of law based on that May 13th, 1996 letter that he construed as a motion under People versus Bremen, 939 P. 2nd, 1348. Which is a 1997 Supreme Court case. The court has to do more than just rubber stamp it with a stamp that says denied, send it to the defendant. He has to make findings of fact and conclusions of law. There were all sorts of issues that screamed out for at least trying to get a limited remand, filing a motion for a limited remand, and advising the defendant that he had the obligation now to supplement his claims properly so that if she was able to get the remand on some of these other issues, that he would have preserved them.
Ms. Remberg, I'm going back to this, what counsel could have known, what counsel could have done, looking at the record. You want to place all these obligations on counsel, and yet all these claims that were raised later came from the defendant himself. There's no indication in the record itself that these claims could be made. I mean, I wasn't the shooter. I mean, that they knew about Reed before having said, I was the shooter. Okay, they knew about that. But this stuff about hiring an expert and all this, I mean, somebody looking at the record at that point in time wouldn't have any indication of those things.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because you would need to go no further than a disposition hearing, where it's very unusual at that disposition hearing. The district attorney is making a big record about how there's all this evidence that flies in the face of this guilty plea. And I cited that Georgia Supreme Court case that it's directly on point, where the Georgia Supreme Court held in that type of situation, defense counsel is ineffective for sitting there and listening to that huge record being made as to why these crimes didn't happen the way that the stipulation of facts says that they happened, and not stop and advise the defendant to not pursue the guilty plea. And
let me follow up on that. Couldn't a reasonable counsel in your shoes today in 2010 advise this defendant that based on what we know now, including the recantation or the the testimony that Reed gave in 08, including the $20 bill not being found or being found on the cab driver, couldn't a reasonable counsel advise this defendant you are still at substantial risk of a first degree murder conviction based on a complicity or other theory? Couldn't you advise? It seems to me that you'd be remiss in not telling the defendant you are facing a substantial risk as we sit here today of being convicted in a retrial or a first trial of first degree murder and at least attempted robbery and conspiracy robbery and a bunch of other crimes.
Well, but that's not how he was advised, and the
expert... No, my question is, wouldn't that be reasonable advice as we sit here today that you are facing a substantial risk of a first-degree murder conviction?
A substantial risk of being an accessory after the fact to second-degree murder for hiding the gun, and he has a substantial risk of being convicted of concealing a weapon.
Let me ask it this way.
He has a academic possibility of being convicted of first-degree murder, but in light of the fact that the actual shooter was only convicted of second-degree murder, that's very, very
serious. Pursuant to a plea, just like his plea.
Right.
But, I mean, a first-degree murder charge would get to a jury, would it not?
It would get to a jury, but the chances are, I don't think the felony murder is going to get to a jury, but the first degree murder hypothetically could get to a jury, but he's facing a very, very slim chance of a conviction of first degree murder as opposed to any of these other things. And see, it would be different. It would be completely different if the sentence had been 20 years or 30 years even, but he stipulated to a 70-year sentence, which is very, very long. And it was the expert witness testified that under those circumstances, it was ineffective assistance of counsel, especially in light of what happened at the disposition hearing, not to advise him to just go ahead and proceed to trial.
I want to wrap up in one or two sentences because of the colloquy. Go ahead, but your time is up.
Well, in conclusion, I would urge the court to not overrule the district court. He made 74 findings of fact, which the district attorney has not argued that he abused his discretion or that are clearly erroneous in his briefs, and those findings of fact support his conclusions of law, and therefore this court should affirm the district court. Thank you.
Appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Your times are exhausted. The-